Hi everyone, and welcome to 4Panel, the Geek Show's dedicated comic book, manga, and sequential art podcast. My name's Rob, and joining me today are Andrew.
Hello, I definitely noticed we've started the show.
And Mick.
Hello, what show?
Oh no, Mick's finally figured out that we've actually recorded an episode.
Yeah.
It's all a Ponzi scheme.
Yep. Today, one of those two is sporting an injury.
I mean, it's not me because I'm young and healthy.
And don't
me because I'm young.
And don't put yourself in any position where you might risk an injury.
No.
No, stay away from all that dangerous sports malarkey.
Yeah, because obviously, being an adrenaline junkie, what I did was I ran in snow.
Now, why would you do a crazy thing like that?
Look, obviously, the fact that
logically, I want to get fit and healthy.
See, the fact that Mick is wounded is deeply sad and concerning, but also you sound like you kind of deserve it.
I wish that I could share with you the YouTube video of me going head over heels in the snow as a result of some mammoth comedy trip, but the truth is, I didn't. I didn't actually fall. I think it was just trying to anticipate potential slippage that caused me to run a bit funny. So I've been hobbling like an old man for the entire week, which is unusual because normally I mask how old a man I am.
I was about to say, what do you mean like an old man?
The mask I normally wear. My facade slipped for a week.
Oh, is it you running through
the
snow?
Thanks for the sympathy, guys.
So it's just you running through the snow going, somebody stop me.
Can we move on to some proper news, please?
Yes.
That's my cue, because I have the news.
Yep.
Oh, but it's been a long day, guys.
You should try hobbling through it.
Sure, it's still as long, you just don't go anywhere.
It hurts more, though.
But you know what doesn't hurt?
What doesn't hurt?
In Infinity Wars, that was a segue. There's been some news about Infinity War. We're going straight into it.
Okay.
So, basically, a bunch of details about stuff, what's going to happen in the film, has been released this week. So, surprise, surprise, Tony Stark's going to have a new suit of armour. Gasp, shock, general murmurs of disbelief.
Yeah, isn't it supposed to be some kind of vibranium armour?
No, it is bleeding edge armour, which actually is a thing that happened a few years ago in the comics. Where it's basically like a bunch of nanites. So you say vibranium, but it is basically like Black Panther's suit. Like it's all stored inside the arc reactor, and then it just kind of flows out all over him.
Okay, now that can be a scene from some weird techno horror movie.
I mean, probably not, but I think it could be cool because looks like it can kind of do some shape shifting stuff. Like there's a picture of Tony Stark with some big sort of wings and.
Yeah, I don't know
if they're like arm swords or weird blaster things.
Yeah, it does look like he's trying to audition for a part in Evangelion or something.
Oh, Gundam.
Yeah. Was it actually called Bleeding Edge in the comics? Because
Yeah, it was, because it's like the most advanced thing ever. Nothing will ever be more advanced until like the next suit he made.
Yeah.
Which was even more advanced.
Because I seem to remember that in when this appeared in the comics, the storyline went that every version of his armour was contained somewhere about his person, even the Hulkbuster.
I don't want to know where the Hulkbuster was kept.
Well, I think just the nanites just configured themselves into whichever suit he wanted.
No, I think that was like the version he had after this.
Oh, that was the bleeding edge.
Yeah, that was the even bleedinger edge.
Even bleedinger edge.
No, this one was weird, because like, in the comics, which I don't think they're going to do in the film, like it was stored underneath his skin.
Ooh.
So it was basically like a cyborg.
Are you sure this isn't some weird techno horror?
Are you sure this isn't when Logan took over as Iron Man?
That would explain all the drinking. Which, I mean, to be fair, Dark also explains all the drinking. Anyway, other things. This is something that's a spoiler for the post-credits of Black Panther. But I'm going to do it anyway because I don't even care. It's been confirmed that Bucky's new nickname in this film is going to be White Wolf, which is what he got called at the end of Black Panther.
Mm.
Which seems kind of weird to me.
Yeah, it wasn't
like, yeah, because in the comics, White Wolf is like a whole separate character.
Yeah, it wasn't he like T'Challa's adopted brother?
Yeah, basically. I mean, I guess I can see why they're going to get rid of him, because I think it was basically the same as Killmonger, in that, like, he became just knockoff Black Panther.
Yeah.
But yeah, it just seems kind of weird and random to just give him that code name. Anyway, the final thing is that Thor is going to get a new hammer.
Yay!
Which I'm slightly excited about, because it's going to be a Stormbreaker, which is the hammer of Beta Ray Bill.
Hang on. He's getting Stormbreaker?
Yeah, I think the idea is he's going to go, like, make that.
So that must be, you know, that scene in the trailer where he's pulling on those things in that ring-shaped thing. That must be the forge.
Yeah. You've got to learn how to describe things better.
No. Mick, if I learn how to describe things better...
You need to learn words.
If I learn how to describe things better, I lose my comedy value, what little there is of it.
Don't push him, Mick. He already knows thing and thing.
And rings.
And other things that end in ing.
If only we hadn't taught Rob to read using only a rhyming dictionary.
This is the problem with having him on a podcast that's devoted to things that are mainly pictorial.
It's all right. The weirdest thing about this conversation is my brother lives in a place called the Ings. I always wondered if some part of word had been chopped off the beginning.
So back to Stormbreaker.
Yeah, well, it looks pretty cool. It's kind of like an axe with a wooden handle.
It says in the article that it may or may not have part of Groot as its handle. I like the way that they've cleared things up nicely there. May or may not. So very much all the options left open.
I mean, at the moment, all we've got to go on is kind of a picture of the child's toy that's getting released. And I really hope that's just what it is in film.
What a child's toy.
What that horrible plasticky look.
Hang on, are you saying Thor's new hammer is going to squeak when it hits people?
He's going to go on a cosmic quest to bring back Stormbreaker, which has boldly emblazoned in runes on the outside, made in China. May contain small parts. Not suitable for children under 3. Oh no, 5.
Yeah, I was going to say.
It must have really small parts.
See, the thing is that scene of Thor pulling the things, as Rob put it, that's actually just a lead-in to a 10-minute long unboxing video.
That's just him getting the packing straps off the Amazon box.
Oh.
And then he hits Thanos with it and it squeaks.
Seriously, Thor having a squeaky hammer is just... See, the more I say it, the more it sounds like something that Loki would do.
True.
Surely he must have at some point.
I so wish that he did.
But the other thing we need to be aware of is, will the various cosmic forces that allow Thor to get his hands on Stormbreaker also supply him with the 2 AAA batteries required to operate it?
Now I'm just imagining a scene like in Batman and Robin where Thor just takes out his Odin credit card because he never leaves home without it.
And I hope that Thor also abides by the ancient rules of Stormbreaker use, which are proudly displayed on the box. Do not hit or swing at people or animals. That could kind of limit its use in the Avengers.
Yeah, as far as incantations go, whoever be worthy may lift this hammer is kind of a step up from that, isn't it?
See, that's the bit that always confused me, because it was always, if they be worthy, they get the power of Thor. And that, and I immediately thought, so someone like Mother Teresa could become Thor, theoretically.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But the other thing that I like about this incantation on the box of that Stormbreaker comes in quite handily for Thor is... to avoid injury, discontinue use if foam is removed.
What foam?
I don't know. It just says discontinue is removed.
But I think what we're saying is Infinity War has a lot of mysteries it needs to answer.
Yeah. And the other big tip in the use of Stormbreaker is use away from breakable objects like, I don't know, New York.
I mean, surely everything is technically a breakable object.
Well, it is if you were wielding a cosmic hammer, surely.
Yeah.
And are ably assisted by the Hulk.
Well, no, he doesn't go back to New York, because remember the last time he kind of broke Harlem.
I think Harlem was pretty broke before he got there, to be fair.
Oh, yeah. And weirdly, no one in Luke Cage ever mentions that.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, I say that like it's not the best we ever get is, hey, remember that time the thing happened?
Yeah, true. But can you imagine if there's like a tourist spot in somewhere in Harlem, in Luke Cage's Harlem, where it's just Hulk's butt print from where he landed butt first?
And that's some millionaire's pool.
Yes.
Anyway, now that we've mocked Infinity War...
Yep, we can go to a different film, which we're not going to do anything to muck up, because it's too good for that. Red, that film that happened ages ago and deserved a sequel and never got one.
But so, we still hope.
We still do. And it just got even better, because Carl Urban revealed that the director of Dread, who I think was like Pete Travis or someone, that was actually a pseudonym for Alex Garland, who really? Directed Ex Machina, one of my favouritest films.
Alex Garland, who wrote The Beach?
I think so.
Yeah, he's an author and a film director. That Alex Garland, all right, cool.
Yeah, I mainly know him from Ex Machina and also Annihilation, which I still haven't seen because it doesn't come out until March 12th and only on Netflix.
Oh, goody.
It's fine. It's fine. I'm not bitter about it.
It's all right. I've got my Netflix now. I'm happy.
I've got my Netflix now, but I want to watch it on the big screen.
Well, why don't you watch it on your Netflix and just sit really, really close?
Or borrow someone's projector.
Possibly because it's not the 1950s and no one owns a projector.
Not that kind of projector. There are high-definition, computer-based projectors available.
Okay, but do people own projectors?
Yes.
That's a thing.
Several of my mates have basically whitewashed their wall and they have a projector TV instead of having a normal TV.
That's crazy.
You say that, but it's a damn sight cheaper than an 80-inch OLED 4K screen.
Yep. I mean, and the sound quality is very good as well.
I'm just baffled by the idea that people have an entire wall they don't have stuff on.
They use it as a TV, so it's got stuff on it. It's just not stuck to it.
It's just moving stuff.
Exactly.
But if you really want to confuse people like that, ask them how their projector projects the colour black.
Yeah, that's not a good thing to ask them.
Because I know someone who worked in the industry of producing projector equipment, and he didn't know how they project the colour black.
Although it is fun listening to them try and explain.
And the only thing that varies from explanation to explanation is the time it takes for you to realise they don't actually know.
Oh, yeah, that's right. There's a Mega City 1 TV show in development.
There is?
Yes, there is.
Which Carl Urban wants to be part of so much.
So has he actually confirmed he wants to play Dredd in the Mega City 1 TV series?
I think
basically... I think that's all he confirms.
Like, I think basically... The basic sort of undertone of the piece is that if you went to Carl Urban and said, I'll give you 20 quid if you play Dread in my living room for 20 minutes, he'd be round there.
I think he'd be round there if you just offered to pay for the petrol.
Yeah.
So hang on, are you saying Carl Urban is now such a big Judge Dread fan, he's basically kitted out his old motorbike to make it look like Dread's motorbike?
I secretly suspect that all those Star Trek sequels are being made purely so that Carl Urban can fund the Dread sequel.
Or his Dread habit.
Nah, because the Mega Collection's nearly over now.
That's not the only Dread stuff that's available. Remember, there are statues, there are costumes, there are replica blasters.
Why would you need a statue of a man you've played?
So you can talk to yourself.
All you need is your costume and the mirror.
Yeah, but it's not the same thing, Mick.
I think they have to keep halting the filming on these Star Trek films because someone just says, Carl, looking awfully bulky today.
Take the Dread boots off.
You're just wearing the entire Judge Dredd costume under your Bones costume.
Oh, can you imagine? You know the
Are you, Carl? No, Carl.
Carl, we can see the badge through the Lycra.
That's what I was about to say. Can you imagine if on his Star Trek uniform, he's embroidered his badge instead of the Star Trek insignia?
Or just put Dredd across the UFP logo.
No. Dredd is written on the back of his shirt, like, you know, those football kits.
See, turns out his bones hair is actually a hairpiece that he's wearing over his dread helmet.
Damn it, man. I'm the law, not a doctor.
But yeah, it certainly seems like if the Rebellion CEO and producer get in touch with Carl, he'll rock up and do a shift.
You say that like he's not already just camped outside there.
I think this is why the Rebellion CEO, Jason Kingsley, and producer Brian Jenkins keep their whereabouts very, very quiet.
Actually, that's the point. If he wants it that badly, surely just walk into their office as Judge Dredd and just scowl at them until they make him the lead.
See, that would
you want
work.
To make a TV show about the law? I am the law.
The thing is, if Dredd walked into their office just dressed in his costume and scowled at them for half a day, I think that could work.
Do you think the reason there's so much crime in Mega City 1 is because at school, when all the children are taught the laws, all it is just a picture of Judge Dredd making a frowny face?
It's possible. That would explain why everyone in Mega City 1 looks a little bit grumpy all the time.
I think it's like they've never been told that murder's illegal. They're just expected to work it out from Judge Dredd's frown.
It's not that he's permanently angry, it's just that he's disappointed.
The one commandment of Judge Dredd, don't do what I do what I say.
But no, I mean, it's nice to see someone who's not treating a comic book film as just a cash cow to be involved with.
Yeah.
Someone who's actually invested in the piece.
I mean, you've got them starting to come more and more out of the woodwork now. The celebrities are starting to wear their geek hearts on their sleeve. Ryan Reynolds was one of the first ones, well, one of the early adopters of this new paradigm.
I think Nick Cage was one of the first.
Yeah, Nick Cage was one of the first, but Ryan Reynolds really pushed it with Deadpool, didn't he?
Yeah, like, I'm pretty sure he's now surgically bonded to that suit.
Well, that was the danger when they didn't make it green or animated.
Yeah, well, thanks for the horrible, horribleness, Mick. Always reliable.
You're welcome. I'm here all week. Try the fish.
So, yeah, where was I before that? I don't care. Move on.
That's the end of all the news I found, but also I just remembered, because we were talking about it, Deadpool news.
Ooh!
Scotty Young's going to be writing the new series, which is awesome because I love Scotty Young.
Cool. He is a good writer.
He is. And also, more importantly, he said in an interview that his Rocket Raccoon series he did, which I absolutely loved, well, it was basically the result of him initially not getting the Deadpool series.
That would explain a lot.
Yeah, of why that series was basically about Rocket Raccoon being a murderous psychopath stealing his way across the galaxy.
Yep. I was about to say, there's a lot of bad-temperedness in that Rocket Raccoon series.
Yeah. So basically, Scotty Young just writes that, but with Deadpool, I will be very happy.
Yes, I think this could work.
We dump on Marvel a lot, which is entirely deserved, but they've been announcing some good stuff.
True, true, true.
Let's hope it lives up to expectations and doesn't explode in a burst of crossovers.
Oh, I'm sure they'll all be cancelled before that can happen.
No, we have to cancel it. This is just too good for readers to have.
I mean, you've just described Mockingbird.
Yep.
Yes.
Why do you hurt me like this, Marvel?
It's true. But then again, Marvel, I'm sure they have somebody in their policy department planning for the SJW backlash.
That's a tricky thing to plan for, though, because the SJWs don't actually seem to know what they want.
Yeah, it's that age-old thing, isn't it? I know you like to protest, but what exactly are you protesting about? We don't care.
Whatever it is you're doing, it's wrong, and we want you to stop it now.
Exactly.
That being said...
But this is the thing we're doing to overturn what we did last week that you said was wrong. We don't care, we don't like it.
Completely unrelated to comics, but did you see in The Sun that they've gone on a weird rant about SJW?
Oh, yeah.
Saying that Frankenstein's monster was the victim. Yes, well done, The Sun. They've accurately summarised the themes of the book Frankenstein.
Yeah. It's been like that since Mary Shelley wrote it. Stop blaming.
I was reading through the comments of that article, and one of them really got me, where they were talking about, you know, they were likening Frankenstein's monster to a gun, and then the reply to that was, maybe I should wander around carrying a concealed Frankenstein's monster then.
Remember, the only thing that can stop a bad guy with a Frankenstein's monster is a good guy with a Frankenstein's mask.
That's the comment. That's the one.
And, you know, I think McDonald's have shown that they just can't win today because did you see the thing about them and International Women's Day?
Oh, they changed. They flipped the M upside down.
Yeah, and then got lambasted for not giving anybody a fair wage.
Which surely makes them the most fair employer in the world.
It's true, you know. Everyone's equal in their misery. Shall we take a break there?
It's probably wise. While we regroup and start thinking about comics again.
Yes.
Wait, this is a comics podcast.
Yes, 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 it is.
The Geek Show is the largest independent podcast network out there. And to be independent, we need a little bit of help every now and again. So if you want something to show your love of The Geek Show, head over to thegeekshow.co.uk, click on the shop and buy some of our lovely wares.
I'm Dylan Horrocks, a cartoonist from New Zealand, and you're listening to The Geek Show.
Ah, there really is nothing like a first leather-bound edition of a classic Victorian podcast. Hello, we're Literary Loitering from The Geek Show, and we cover literally all types of books, from hardbacks to paperbacks to sometimes the words within them. If any of these things interest you, why not pop in and give us a visit on Literary Loitering.
Welcome back, and now it's time for some comics. So, kicking us off is Mick. What have you got for us, Mick?
Well, you'll be pleased to know that this week sees the return of the sadly and late lamented Inhumans Watch.
Hooray!
Hang on, isn't... Just this is, I think, the first time we've actually done Inhumans in an official capacity in this section.
Normally we did it in the news bit, didn't we?
No, I mean, I did Royals, but it was technically Inhumans, but that was comics that I bought. This has actually been sent to us, I mean, in that official capacity.
All right.
So this is a landmark moment, Mick.
Yeah, a landmark moment. And I'm guessing that you don't want me to screw it up and disappoint.
So what was it you said, Andrew?
So Inhumans Watch is finally above board.
We're legitimizing Inhumans Watch. Okay, well, you know how frustrating it is when you get hold of a comic or a graphic novel and you really get invested in the characters and you really love the characters, and then Hollywood get hold of it and make either a TV show or a film and completely ruin it, and you cry over the fact that they've ruined the source material.
Yes.
So X-Men 3, basically.
Well, you'll be pleased to know that Inhumans did not disappoint.
Okay, that's a confusing statement.
Because what we got in the Inhumans TV series is exactly what this source material deserved.
Ah.
Hooray?
Yes, thanks ABC for giving us what we deserved from this source material.
And so are you saying Inhumans is like, you know that Ron Seal thing does exactly what it says on the tin? The Inhumans TV series was the superhero TV show version of that?
Kinda, yeah. Now, the thing is, legendary writer Christopher Priest.
Oh.
Christopher Priest? What's he doing here?
Something tells me this ain't going to end well, is it?
What this is a kind of prequel to the series. So it's basically the story of the Inhumans that we know and love from the TV show as teenagers.
Oh, God.
Exactly.
I can smell trouble.
And it takes place somewhere between Maximus and Black Bolt's parents' death, leaving a vacancy on the throne, and it deviates slightly from the backstory that we got in the TV show. And the throne is usurped by someone who's not related to them, but realizes that they are the rightful heirs once they're old enough to take the place and they've gone through Terrigenesis and all the rest of it.
And so he kills both of them, thus averting the dark future where the Inhumans TV show gets made. Hooray!
Well, that's such a much better story. So this is the Boltagon Legacy?
See, when you say the Boltagon Legacy, it sounds like a power tool.
Well, I remember that there was a cheap sort of Perspex crossover between Lego and Meccano available when I was a kid, and it had a similar kind of name.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm thinking like the Black & Decker Workmate using conjunction with the Boltagon Legacy.
Also, more importantly, I'd completely forgotten that Blackbolt's real name is just Blackagar Boltagon.
Yeah. Well, I've just reminded you of that, so I apologise for that. And then basically there's a bit of a rebellion from the alpha primitives, led by someone who's got inhibitors that prevent the inhumans using their powers. And then it becomes this sort of angsty teen drama where they're stranded on Earth because they've had to escape the wrath of the king for seemingly siding with the rebels.
And do they have, like, typical teenage adventures on Earth?
I wouldn't say they were typical.
Wait, are you sure this is supposed to be, like, a prequel to the TV show?
No, it's not supposed to be. It's a prequel in so much as it's set before it.
Okay, but it's not actually that continuity.
No.
Okay, because I was going to say that they definitely haven't been to Earth before.
Exactly. It jumps around between their past on Atalan and their present on Earth and on Atalan. There are characters that come in that have spuriously described origins, if they're described at all. And it only picks up, there's five comics collected here, the Once and Future Kings numbers 1 to 5. It only really picks up in issue 4 when your friendly neighbourhood Spider-Man comes along. There's no real explanation as to why Spider-Man comes along, but he does. There's this weird thing in the panels as well where every 3 or 4 panels or every couple of pages, there's a panel that's just black with a caption that looks like it should be the title for the issue, but the issue title's already been gone. And it's frankly a mess, and it's not even a mess that you want to spend effort and time picking out. The story, when you figure out what it is weak at best. The art style is quite nice. It's got a sort of, it manages to look like pastel shades, but still quite vivid, which is an interesting technique. But if you actually want to get something enjoyable out of this, look to the Lockjaw spoofs at the back, because they're really quite funny.
Yeah, but like, Lockjaw, who doesn't love Lockjaw?
Well, these are written by Ryan North and art by Gustavo Duarte. And they're like a sort of Sunday funnies style. So there's one called Don't Stop Retrieving, which is where...
And I like it.
It's an excellent pun.
Which is where the Thing takes Lockjaw out and starts throwing sticks for him. But, of course, this is Lockjaw and the Thing, so the stick is actually a tree. There's another one called Are You Kidding Me?
Oh, that's just the good side of bad.
Which is Lockjaw and Wolverine.
Okay, now that's a combination that I must read.
On a trip to the kitten dimension.
Oh.
And then you've got Lockjaw. Subtitle of all these is Canine Master of Time and Space. Where, and I can't believe I'm actually looking at this as I say it. It's called Peer Pressure, but peer is spelled as in an unfinished bridge.
Yeah.
Okay. And the Watcher is presiding over a sandcastle contest. And the competitors are The Thing, Medusa, Dr. Octopus, Johnny Storm, Deadpool, and Lockjaw's just on the beach. Oh, an incredible squirrel girl goes past, and much hilarity ensues. And then there's Cosmic Rube.
Sorry.
And then there's Cosmic Rube, which is Lockjaw versus Thanos.
See, that sounds normal. It's the one before that kind of sticks in the mind a little bit, Mick.
And then you've got Lockjaw and Spider-Man taking on J. Jonah Jameson in A Christmas Peril.
Are they like the Ghosts of Future Past?
Yes. Yeah.
God, I've also just accidentally pitched the best comic ever, a mashup between Christmas Carol and Days of Future Past.
Oh, God.
So basically... if you pick up this collection or someone buys you it for a birthday present or something, don't bother with the main story, which takes up, like, you know, 95% of the book. Just turn to the Lockjaw comic strips at the back, because you'll have far more entertainment out of 5 minutes with those than you will out of an hour or so reading the rest of it.
Sounds about right.
Ebenezer Scrooge, you must repent your greedy ways.
and also travel to the future to stop the Sentinels.
James, is that you? Is that you, James Howlett?
I'm going to pitch this idea to Marvel right now. That's it, podcast's over. I'm done. I don't need you losers anymore. I'm going to make millions.
So that's me done with Inhumans.
It's Andrew's turn.
Okay, so I have been reading Not Hellboy.
Hellgirl?
Not Hellboy.
Yeah, to make a nice change, I've instead been reading From the Pages of Hellboy, BPRD Hell on Earth New World by Mike Mignola with art by John Arcudi.
You are our kind of Hellboy BPRD correspondent now, aren't you?
I mean, in as much as what happens is you get Hellboy stuff in and I immediately yell, I'll take that, snatch it and run from the cafe screeching into the night.
I can't wait until Mike Mignola hears that and does a comic about you.
That I think my life would be complete if I appeared as a weird demon boy in a Hellboy comic.
The Howling Night Cackler.
But then when that got reviewed by Andrew on 4Panel, that'd be a sort of kind of Inception moment, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Andrew reviewing The Howling Night Cackler, a story of his life.
Yeah, I think what happens then is I just start bending over until my head is firmly rammed up my own behind.
And then you go, oh, look, the sun.
At which point you become film critic for The Independent.
That's very well done. So anyway, this... So, I'm actually quite curious about this. We got this from Turnaround, right?
Yes.
Because this story was like written in 2010, so I'm not really sure what it's doing getting released now.
I think it's. I think it might be a re-release, or maybe that it wasn't released originally.
I looked at it. It was definitely released a few years ago, but you know, it's almost like there's some kind of new Hellboy film coming up, so they're re-releasing a bunch of old stuff.
Is there really? I never knew.
You can't see, but I'm stroking my imaginary beard right now.
Yeah, that's coming over really well on the podcast, Andrew.
It is. This is a very good bit, and I'm glad it worked out fantastically well. The secret is just to keep on committing to it until it's funny. Even if we're here all night.
Note to self.
We very well, maybe.
Yeah, note to self. Buy Andrew some props so he can do some Foley.
I think that just makes it worse if I have actual props that no one will know I'm using.
Just the sound of you stroking your beard.
Yeah, I don't even know what that would sound like. But what it wouldn't sound like is me actually talking about BPRD Hell on Earth.
Tell us more about BPRD Hell on Earth.
Okay, so this is set after an event known as the Frog War, which basically was a big event in the BPRD books. It was a kind of a global war against a bunch of demon frog people, which has left a lot of the world in ruins. Like, I think they say like kind of half of China's gone and San Francisco is basically just a volcano now. And after that, the BPRD have kind of been brought under the United Nations, so they're now an official government body tasked with investigating paranormal events. And the main one in this book is Abe Sapien. Well, it kind of goes a bit rogue to investigate a small town in Canada where everyone's disappeared.
Hang on. Are you saying Abe Sapien, perpetual good guy, is now playing the bad cop?
I mean, less bad cop, more loose cannon who plays by his own rules, but god damn it, he gets results.
Oh god, I must read this.
Yeah, he does that, and he teams up with Ben Daimo, the werewolf man.
Yes.
Who is also half Japanese and should, in no universe, be played by Ed Skrein. So yeah, they investigate the disappearances, and spoiler alert, it's a horrifying abomination doing it.
Isn't it always?
It is. But I especially love the monster in this one, because it's basically just like a giant mouth. Like, basically imagine the Sarlacc pit from Star Wars, but if that grew a bunch of tentacles, pulled itself out of the earth, and just started, like, rolling around. It's disgusting, and I love it. And just, I've got to give big props to John Arcudi, because just the way he draws it is really unsettling. You can almost see the tentacles moving. as it just sort of whips and thrashes about.
I'm refusing to comment here because I know I'll say something that'll set you off, Andrew.
I'm surprised half that description didn't set you off.
It's fine. It's all good. For all our listeners in America, they'll be deeply unsettled. For all our listeners in Japan, they'll be feeling some different emotions.
Yes, and all those followers of Cthulhu in the world.
God, oh, no. Cthulhu followers probably really love that kind of anime, don't they?
Well, you know more about Cthulhu than I do, Andrew.
Oh, no, that's... I've never made that kind of... Oh, I'm upset now. Anyway, Hell on Earth is really good. It's good because you don't really need to have followed the BPRD comics. Like, you can pretty much get what's going on just from the context clues. And kind of the main story itself just works really well as kind of a standalone of supernatural horror story.
I think that's one of the things I liked about BPRD and the Hellboy comics in general, though, was that there were a lot of standalone stories. You know, you got the setting. You know, you understood what the whole setting was. It was, but they were all individual. They didn't need to relate to each other.
Oh, yeah. Well basically, Hellboy especially is pretty much just a series of mini-series.
Yeah.
And this is less so because there is also kind of a plot line that ties into the bigger stuff with, like, mounting tensions within the base between Johann Kraus and a mummy called Pania.
When you say mounting tensions, you're not talking about
not like that.
Right,
not
okay.
That kind of anime, Rob.
I'm just checking, because, you know, comics are fundamentally weird.
That being said, yes, but, oh no, what if that's where this plotline does lead to? Because I don't know as much about BPRD as I do Hellboy. Oh, I can't say for sure that these two characters don't hook up.
Hold on, you didn't put that on your application form to be the Hellboy expert.
No, he's an expert on Hellboy, not BPRD.
Well, I'm sorry, but, you know, you've got to be just wider than one.
I would say, of all the people on the podcast, I probably know the most about BPRD.
That's not the point. You're here under false pretenses.
You're not my employer.
You'll be given Jabberowski.
Oh, no.
No. You don't have to worry. I'll explain more later. Mick's kind of let himself in for it.
That's good. Also, for the record, I'm very skilled at both admin and social media marketing. I know all about those things. So if people who employ me were just to happen to listen, I definitely know what I'm doing in my job. I don't
bear that in mind when it comes to being a social media lead.
Oh, it's fine. I'll probably be arrested for fraud long before then.
Anyway, BPRD.
Yeah, it's just a good old fun time.
Excellent. Do you know what wasn't a good old fun time?
Was it actually BPRD? Because I lied, because it's all full of death and destruction and that kind of good stuff.
No, Avengers and Champions. Worlds Collide.
Oh, no. Those are two things that sound like they wouldn't be a fun time. Especially with a collision between the two.
Well, this is collecting Avengers 672 and 674. Avengers 672 to 674, which was it? And Champions issues 13 to 15. And it's weird, right? It's weird. Where are they?
It's okay, Rob. Just tell us about it.
It's broken him.
Oh, is this another Justice League versus Suicide Squad scenario?
No, I'm trying to find the writers' names. All right, okay, found it.
Not so they can be paraded through the streets and beaten with sticks.
It says on the front, Wade, Ramos, Size, and Pina.
Well, surely Wade is Mark Wade, writes Champion.
Yeah.
So it's probably a good bet that he was the writer for at least some of this.
Okay, so, Mark Wade, who writes Champions, and whoever wrote Avengers 672 to 674. I can't be bothered looking for them. It starts off with Spider-Man trying to give a message to what I think is a camera, and then for some reason the scene shifts, vibrates, and then he becomes Miles Morales, who's continuing the message. And the message is all about how they've got minutes to save the Earth. You know, Earth only has minutes to live. And then the scene shift.
Oh, wait a sec.
Yeah?
Mark Wade writes Avengers as well.
Oh, okay. So that would explain a lot.
But isn't that the fact that you can't find a second writer because there's only one writer?
Yeah, possibly. But anyway, the scene shifts to Falcon rescuing Grandma and Vision and Viv Vision, and there's a fire, and Vision is basically being abrupt with Viv. She goes in to save the fireman, and Vision then tells her off, saying that because of her, the fireman could have died. You know, the fireman was distracted by her and could have died, but she actually saved him, and she's unhappy because, you know, family, you know, parents, that sort of thing. She goes back to the Avengers, where Amadeus is being his typical smarmy self with Nova, and kind of annoying Nova by being the eighth smartest person in the world, and everyone's kind of at loggerheads with everyone else. What's her face? You know, the new Wasp. She is talking to Spider-Man about stuff. And then all of a sudden in space, while they're watching this satellite that's suddenly going to be in position to see something in space, there's a rift in space and a meteor flies out of this rift and it's heading to Earth and it could destroy the entire Western Hemisphere. And so the Avengers mobilize. And the Avengers this time are Falcon and Vision and Wasp and Jane Foster, Thor and Hercules and Spider-Man. But the Champions are also on the way to the rescue. The Champions being Kid Cyclops, who is actually Adult Cyclops, but now he's a kid again for some reason.
Time-traveling
Cyclops. Ms. Marvel, Viv Vision, Miles Morales, Spider-Man, Nova, and Amadeus Cho, whatever his name is, totally awesome Hulk. And so you've got this clash of ideals between old and young, which is setting everything up. Ms. Marvel is the...
Just like this podcast.
Yep. Ms. Marvel is the leader of the Champions, and she's not happy to have, the adults running roughshod over, over everything that they're doing and are arbitrarily making the decisions for her team. But the Earth is going to be hit by this meteor. And so she knuckles down to get the job done, and they basically slow the meteor down in stages, doing various things and things like that. But there's an underlying thing, there's an underlying tone to this that's going on between Viv Vision and her dad, the Vision. Lo and behold, the meteor is not a straightforward thing. Thor's hammer, Mjolnir, picks up a weird vibration from it, a low frequency vibration, which seems to have caused some sort of effect, they're not sure what, but then the tallest buildings in the world start vibrating and blah blah blah, things start happening, these buildings may collapse, so Avengers and Champions have to mobilize into teams and they have to go rescue people. But out of this meteor comes this Minotaur, and you're like, oh, Hercules versus the Minotaur. Turns out the mega culprit behind all of this is the High Evolutionary, who I haven't seen in a comic book for a while.
Yeah, he was busy lighting up.
And plotting all this shenanigans, clearly.
Yeah, he's...
Don't be silly. High Evolutionary can't plot anything. He's too busy being off his guard.
Yeah. See, the thing is, Andrew's kind of right. He is a bit off it in this. I mean, he's created all these creatures, and they all regard him as God, and he is... He reckons he's found the ability to become immortal, and he is now immortal. And he, you know, he's created this vibration to try and bring the other Earth that he owns, which is on the other side of the sun, so we never see it. And so, Nova's coming up with ideas that prove that he does have a brain, and he does think, and he does listen and learn. But fundamentally, this is a clash of ideals between old and young, and that plays out even with the High Evolutionary as well, because little did I know, he has a daughter.
Well, that's just a bad influence. You have parental responsibilities, High Evolutionary, not Revolutionary. Put down the death sticks.
Oh no, it gets even...
Stop smoking that ganja.
It gets even worse, because two of the super friends, Falcon and Viv Vision get kidnapped by the High Evolutionary and taken to the other Earth, where he plans to operate on Falcon and turn him into an actual Birdman. But he first is fascinated by Viv Vision, and he understands why she was made, and so he then proceeds to turn her fully human.
See, I didn't realise how well this joke was going to work, because everything you say just sounds like the mad ramblings of someone who has had way too much.
Yeah, the thing is, right, you know when you look at Vision, right, and this is the bit where I kind of went, you what? You know when you look at Vision, and Vision being kind of pink and green, or yeah. red and green?
Because he is the most festive Avenger.
Would you think that Vision was then dark-skinned?
No.
Because for some reason, Viv Vision, after the High Evolutionary gets his hands on her, becomes a dark-skinned, black-haired, with a pink streak, female human with green eyes.
I mean, as opposed to what?
Well, I'm just saying that I've never actually questioned what race would Vision be, because I always assumed with his kind of mental whatever it is coming from Wonder Man, I always assumed he would be white.
I mean,
and I'm not knocking the choice.
I guess
I'm not knocking the choice. It's a talking point, and it's not that it's done badly. I'll be honest, it's actually just done and presented as is, and I like the fact that they don't actually draw attention to it, like I just did.
Okay, I guess. I mean, it's one of those things I've never thought about. It would be like saying, but what kind of cat would Selina Kyle be if she got turned into one?
Well, obviously black.
I mean, I guess. Is this what other people think about?
Yeah, this is what normal people think about.
This is not what normal people think about, Rob.
This is what they do, isn't it, while they're watching their movies on their blank walls with their projectors.
Yeah. Anyway,
hey, no one accused those people of being normal.
True. Anyway.
And lighting up their 6 months on their Earth that's on the other side of the sun so that they can vibrate themselves to immortality.
Yeah. Anyway, somehow, Vision isn't happy with the fact that High Evolutionary has kidnapped Viv. There's a lot more going on there than you think. He's also freaked out by the fact that Viv is now human. The Avengers and the Champions go back to rescue Viv, and that's when they find out that the High Evolutionary has a daughter, or rather, Viv finds out that the High Evolutionary has a daughter. This all culminates in surprising fashion, which then is not so surprising. Should I spoil or not?
I mean, I think you should definitely spoil the heartwarming ending, where all the Avengers finally just convince the High Evolutionary to get the help he needs at rehab, so that he can be the father his daughter needs.
Well,
and it ends with them all turning to confront the reader and say, remember, kid, winners don't do drugs.
Basically, High Evolutionary's daughter has trapped herself in the heart of the planet. She's trapped herself there because he wanted to get rid of his creations, and she was compassionate towards them. And she's telling this to Viv, and she's saying, look, I'll turn this machine off, I'll stop the worlds colliding, only to have Vision and the rest of the Avengers and the rest of the Champions pour in, look at her, assume that she's the bad guy because she looks like the High Evolutionary, start attacking her after Viv's already convinced her to turn the machine off, and so Viv is forced to turn the machine off, which means she technically dies.
But don't worry, everyone, she probably gets better since she's in the solicitations for upcoming books.
She does get better. She meets the High Evolutionary, who is apparently a data stream. She's now apparently a data stream. Vision is rebuilding Viv. And at the moment he rebuilds Viv, she manages to make it back, but in her human form. And it ends with, next in Champions, double trouble, because you now have two Viv Visions. One human, one not.
What?
Drugs. Not even one.
Yeah. Also, the underlying thing about Vision, why he's been kind of a hard ass on Viv, is because he knew she only had a human lifespan, which suggests that Vision is immortal.
Or that he has a longer than human lifespan.
Potato, potato.
I mean, he's only a robot. Robot parts break eventually.
Yeah, but he can replace them, can't he? He has a self-healing factor as well. They actually talk about it in this.
Yeah, but surely he's got like a CPU, and that's going to degrade eventually. If my Game Boy cannot work after years, he cannot work after years.
Your Game Boy wasn't an artificially intelligent cyborg.
Oh, when you're talking about a robot healing
factor. Can you play
factor?
Pokemon Silver on the Vision? No, you can't.
How do you know? Have you tried?
Yes. He was very disappointed when I tried to put it in the slot.
And he was particularly grumpy with how he handled the joypad.
Oh, anyway.
Surely a robot's self-healing factor is a toolkit.
No, apparently it's not for him.
Okay.
It might be like Tony Stark's nanites, you know, his robot suit.
Has he got a very small travel can of WD-40?
and roll a duct tape. That's his emergency first aid kit.
That's his healing factor.
I mean, that's what Tony Stark's nanites are. They're just tiny robots with spanners.
Healing factor GTX is coursing through my veins.
Anyway, who's next?
Is it me?
Yes.
Might be. Who knows?
Okay. Well, I have been reading Voices of a Distant Star, which is a manga by Makoto Shinkai and art by Mizu Sahara. Basically, a sci-fi romance.
Yeah. Do you want a bit of background to this, Mick? Or did you read up on it?
No, give me background.
Okay, a bit of background to this. Makoto Shinkai is a very well-known anime director. His most recent film, Your Name, has done very, very well at the box office. It's the best-selling anime movie of all time so far, even beating out Spirited Away by Studio Ghibli. Voices of a Distant Star was his... He did a project right at the beginning called She and Her Cat, and then after that he did this half-hour animated feature called Voices of a Distant Star, and it's remarkable because it was all done by him on a Mac over a period of several years, and the only voice caster, it's very limited on budget and everything like that, but it proved once for all that a single person could do high quality animation themselves. They didn't need to rely on a studio, it just take them a bit longer to do it.
Okay.
And Voices of a Distant Star was what actually started his career as a director as well. So this is one of those rare occasions where it was an anime first before it became a manga.
So this is basically the manga adaptation of an anime short, effectively.
Yeah, it's a half-hour episode, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But is it a self-contained episode?
It's a self-contained episode.
All right. So this manga adaptation, which I may go off and find the anime later, was first published in 2005 and is now being translated by Vertical Comics, which is a hell of a name for a company. I've got an image now of Vertical Comics. But back to Voices of a Distant Star. Yes, it's a manga romance novel in a sci-fi tale, which really doesn't sound like it's my bag. But I actually found myself really enjoying it, because it's not a romance in a way that tugs at your heartstrings. It's not the kind of romance story that will have you collapsing in tears on the backseat of the bus as you read it on the way to work. Honestly, that never happened. But it is quite touching and it's quite moving. And it's based on a very interesting conceit, this idea that the further in space you travel, the longer it will take for any messages to get to Earth and responses to get to you.
Time dilation. That's what it's called.
No, just distance. It's nothing to do with time dilation. It's just distance. No, but it takes longer to travel further.
Yeah, I know, but that's what I'm saying. That it's basically, isn't that like, or am I thinking of the, is it time dilation then?
No, time dilation is a completely different thing.
Okay.
That's where your experience of time is different because of the speed you're traveling.
Ah, right, okay.
Yeah, that.
Hey, I was just clarifying because I was confused.
And that's A-level physics 101. You're welcome. So, Voices of a Distant Star. One thing I will say about this is I really wish that there was a sort of deluxe edition where the colour panels are done throughout, because there's spits and spots that are done in full colour and they're really beautiful. I mean, the artwork's gorgeous throughout, but the colour panels that you get some at the beginning of chapter one, and then they're interspersed throughout. They're not always at the beginning of a chapter. They just seem to be, oh, do you know what? I think I'll spoil the reader and give them a bit of colour now. They really make the artwork pop and just be just that little extra element of gorgeousness.
Yeah, but just think, Mick, if they spoiled you with all that colour all of the time, you know, you might not appreciate it as much the next time. So they just give you enough to keep you eager and keen.
Well, I could understand that over the course of like 17 issues, but you know, when it's a self-contained volume, that kind of sales pitch doesn't work. But it is a shame because when it is in colour, it really, really sets off the artwork. As I say, the artwork is pretty gorgeous throughout. There's a couple of times where it gets a little bit confusing because they try and have characters finishing the same kind of thought process as part of their inner monologue, almost as if the two characters are thinking the same thing, just separated by distance. But the premise is that Mikako Nagamine and Noboru Terao are two students at middle school that start to have feelings for each other. And just as they're on the verge of sort of becoming serious with things, Mikako is recruited as a pilot to fight in an interstellar war against some unseen alien invaders.
Well, that's just a tale of as old as time, isn't it?
What? Boy meets girl, girl goes off to fight unseen alien invaders.
Bloomin' typical.
I thought the tale as old as time was Beauty and the Beast.
Yes, it is. Well done, Mav. You got a reference.
So Mikako goes off, and obviously they keep in touch. The bloom of new love. They keep in touch through text. But of course, she goes to train on Mars, so the texts take a few days to reach Noboru. And then she completes her training on Mars, so that she moves out to Saturn, and the texts take twice as long to reach him. So suddenly it's gone from getting a text message every few days to every few weeks. And then she goes out onto her next mission, which is at the edge of the solar system. And suddenly it's taking weeks. And then she goes out beyond the solar system into Alpha Proxima to take the fight to the Tharsians. And suddenly it's like weeks, months, years for these text messages to reach Noboru. And in the meantime, he's gone on to high school. He's started studying engineering. He's met other people. He thinks that she's forgotten him because she's not getting these texts. He's sort of reaching sort of his early 20s. She's still 16 and out in fighting in effectively like a Gundam suit against these aliens.
So there is time dilation then.
That's why I was confused.
No, because time dilation is an effect. No one is affected by time dilation. They're both just...
Mick, is it good or not? Yes or no?
Yes, it is very, very good. I'm surprised that I liked it. I honestly didn't think I was going to, other than it having the sci-fi element. I didn't think it was going to be good. But the sci-fi takes a backseat, but not enough to make it not sci-fi. And it's just beautifully drawn, well written, and well worth a read. Over 10 chapters.
Fantastic. Andrew.
Okay, so finally I have Mystery Men, The Golden Age from Marvel. And this was written by David Liss, who you'll remember did the Black Panther thing that I did the other week.
Yep.
With art by Patch Zercher.
Okay. That should get some kind of award as best name of the week.
I want to ask something, just to get this out of the way. Does this have anything to do with that Ben Stiller movie or with The Flaming Carrot?
Oh, yeah, I completely forgot that movie. No, this is completely unrelated.
Right, okay.
This is Mystery Men in the traditional sense of the word, which is a bunch of 1930s pulp heroes. Although, interestingly, and quite rare for a comic book written fairly recently from one of the big two, these are all completely new characters.
Ooh, now that is unusual.
Yeah, I mean, I say new, they're kind of... They're sort of new, but also quite familiar, because each one of them sort of embodies a lot of the traditional sort of 30s and 40s pulp heroes. So you've got the operative, who is designed very much like the Spirit, just the classic. He's got a suit, he's got a fedora, and he has a mask, although he wears a ski mask instead of the traditional domino mask.
Okay.
So he starts off, he's kind of this gentleman thief. Who, robs from the rich. I don't think he even gives to the poor. He just kind of robs from the rich. Yeah, just to mess with them, really.
Hang on. When you say gentleman thief, does he make appointments with them and let them know he's going to rob them?
No, he does something much classier, which is leave his very own heavily stylized calling card.
Okay.
Which I kind of love, because it probably just looks like a business card.
And does it say on it, you have been robbed by so-and-so? If you enjoyed this experience and would like to...
Please call our customer service department, where you'll be asked to invite... You'll be invited to take part in a short survey.
Yes.
Well, no, it's just a piece of card with the operative written on it. But it's also got, a shadowy figure standing behind it, and it just, it looks so much like a company logo.
Hang on, are you saying this operative was the original version of the Milk Tray Man?
Yes, that's the twist, Rob. You've ruined the book. He's the Milk Tray Man.
Bringing diabetes to women everywhere.
But no, he's quite happy just going about doing his stealing stuff until his father, who is kind of a crazy general, ends up murdering his girlfriend as part of a ritual to summon one of the Fear Lords, who is an ancient god that feeds on fear. And just isn't that always the way?
Now that is indeed a tale as old as time.
Well, yeah, 1930s, which, as we know, is the start of all time.
Yes.
So anyway, he ends up having to team up with a bunch of other heroes so that they can all stop the general and his dark mistress Nox from killing a bunch of children and generally making a bad time, is, I think, their exact plan.
This is sounding a lot like BPRD.
It is kind of similar in the sort of trying to prevent a semi-Lovecraftian apocalypse. So he ends up teaming up with the Revenant, who is a black magician's assistant, who's falsely accused of assaulting a woman, and so decides to use his magical knowledge as a vigilante.
Does he dress like a bear?
No, he does not. He dresses much cooler than a bear, because he wears a white tuxedo and kind of like a cowl and has fingers gloves.
But I like him. So you say?
I was just saying, I like him because he's very much like in the style of sort of Mandrake the Magician, that kind of character, where just like appears in puffs of smoke. And there's a bit where like someone tries to shoot him and he just catches the bullet in his mouth.
See, the way you're describing the operative and the Revenant, you make them sound like members of some 1930s all-gentleman group.
Well, they're not all gents here, because there's also the Aviatrix, who is the sister of the operative's girlfriend. Ooh. And it is very, very heavily based on the Rocketeer, by which I mean, imagine the Rocketeer, but she's a woman and her jetpack has wings.
Okay.
And she's cool, because there's one bit where like she's interrogating a thug. And like by this point, she's got sick of kind of a lot of other characters being a little bit condescendingly sexist, you know, just in the kind of, oh no, don't get involved in this fight. It's no place for a lady. And it's like she's just hanging this thug like in the middle of the air going just, oh no, my poor weak womanly arms. I sure hope they can hold on for longer. You better hurry up and tell me or I might just drop you.
I like it.
She's great. I would say she's probably my second favourite, because my favourite is the surgeon, who is basically a surgeon whose village gets attacked by the general. No, he gets attacked by a bunch of thugs who, like, burn his house down, and his entire body gets covered in burns, and he just goes completely insane, wraps himself head to foot from bandages, puts on, like, an old surgeon's outfit and a tattered cloak, and just starts cutting up people with scalpels.
So kind of an early version of Darkman.
Yeah, he is very Darkman. And he's also got like vials full of glowing green liquid that he injects people with. And I just love that, like in the artist notes, it even just says, just don't ask what's in the vial.
Does he just inject them because he can?
Well, the idea is it's kind of like anesthetic to knock them out, you know, before he hacks them apart with a scalpel.
Okay.
I just love that everything he says is like really hammy and over the top. Like, he's full on, like, crime is a disease and I have to cut out the symptoms.
Oh, God. So you just remind me of a horrible, horrible manga series, which I'm not going to go into.
It is, but imagine that, but, like, kind of knowingly over the top.
See, that I could accept.
But, like, there's a bit where just, like, he sneaks up and stabs someone in the neck with one of his syringes and just says, I like it when their veins are easy to find.
Do you know, that's the second time I've heard the phrase veins are easy to find today.
And anyway, the surgeon, he teams up with Achilles, who is like very early superhero stereotype. Like he's an archaeologist who finds an amulet that turns him into a super strong hero. Like very, very Hawkman, but also with the side effect that every time he uses his amulet, he loses a year of his life. And the only way to replenish that is with a life.
So, how long does his transformation last?
Basically, it's explained. It's not so much the transformation that doesn't last. It's every time he does a heroic deed.
That's a bit vague, isn't it?
It is, which means he has to kill a lot of people. But as the surgeon says, all medicines have their side effects. I don't really like the surgeon because he's just completely mental. And yeah, Mystery Men, it's... Yeah, I really enjoyed it, mainly because I'm a sucker for some 1930s superheroes.
It sounds like it's the same kind of good fun as, oh, what was the one, Doc Unknown that I covered a few weeks back.
Yeah.
Same sort of vibe.
Yeah, I think it is, because it's very much, it's like in the style of old 1930s comics, but with a lot more modern sensibilities. And Patch Searcher does some really great art in it. Like, especially there's one panel where the operative finds out his girlfriend's dead, and the idea is he's wearing his mask, and you can just see his eyes, and he absolutely nails the expression of just, like, horror and sadness.
Awesome.
And then also, this has a backup feature, which is the origin of the Phantom Reporter, who is another early Marvel hero. He was featured in a series that came out a while ago called The 12, where it's basically about a bunch of World War II superheroes, shockingly enough, 12 of them, who kind of got frozen at the end of the war and got thawed out in modern times like Captain America and got embroiled in this big murder mystery thing.
I might have to look that one up.
I think I've read the first few issues, and yeah, it seemed pretty fun. I'll have to chase the rest of that up. Oh, wait, this is The Phantom Reporter, written again by David Liss, but with art by Jason Armstrong. And it's just, it's a fun little origin story.
Awesome. 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 That's about it for today. We're at the end of the show. All of our shows are available.
There was one bit of news we missed.
Oh?
But, Rob, remind me, have you got Netflix?
Yes.
All right. Okay. So it'll be just you and me then going off after the podcast to watch Jessica Jones Season 2. Which
no, it'll very much also be me. I didn't say I didn't have Netflix.
Oh, didn't you?
No, I have Netflix. I want to watch Annihilation on the big screen. Hmm. And you're very aware that Jessica Jones is out now. And that we spent a bajillion years recording this podcast.
Yes, I know. I was about to close it off.
That's over now. Go away, everyone.
Yes. All of our shows are available on...
It's done. We're over. End podcast.
let me finish it.
Don't forget we have a new outlet. Before you do all the outlets that we're available on, we have a new outlet.
Which one?
People in Stockton can listen to our podcast in Geek Corner, your local comic store.
Oh, okay. But they're also available on Apple Podcasts and Audioboom as well. Visit the website for all sorts of reviews and stuff. Our links to Patreon are on there as well. So show your support. If you want to get in touch with us, you can find us on Facebook or our own Twitter, which is Andrew, 4Panel Podcast, was it?
Yeah, that. You can find it yourselves, you big people.
Yes. Or you can email us, studio@thegeekshow.co.uk. Until next week, I've been Rob.
I've been Andrew.
And I've been Mick.
We'll see you all later.
Thanks for listening.